Welcome back to Techonomics. I am your host, Jason Middleton. Thinkers and economists have been dissecting the Great Recession and its fallout for about 8 years now. Oh, and one person has gone to jail over the most massive loss of wealth due to unethical behavior since then, too, by the way. But I digress. One economist has fashioned a new model for markets to use, one where central banks are given even more tools to manipulate markets and keep things on the road forward and out of the ditch of recession. Even if you don't know Keynes or his general theory, the new book, Prosperity for All, spells out in human terms just how outdated our economic approach is, and it proffers a way to fix that. We spoke to a well-respected economist and author about his new approach.
Professor Roger Farmer.
And you're the author of Prosperity for All. It's a response to the Great Recession of 2008. And there are many ways we could attack this, but I think we should start with preventing financial crises. And I'm going to ask you, we have a Fed decision pending on an interest rate hike. So I think that's a good hook for us to get in. You argue that central banks are kind of leading the way or should be leading the way moving forward. Can you help flesh that out for me a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So a big part of the book is about the connection between Wall Street and Main Street, the real economy. And we see Wall Street go up and down. We see financial markets move. And for a long time, economists have really ignored the feedback from that part of from the financial markets to the real economy. What I argue in the book is that a lot of the movements in financial markets actually cause movements in the real economy. And for that reason, I think that we should be thinking about designing institutions that can help prevent the bad effects of volatile financial markets on unemployment and real growth. You ask about how to do that. Well, I think that we should be thinking more about having something like a central bank or the Treasury intervene directly in financial markets to help prevent instability and to help maintain full employment.
Okay, so the dual mandate coming out of the 40s was for the Federal Reserve to have inflation and full employment. Is that still valid?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely valid. I think that whereas we have, as you point out, a dual mandate, we've really only been thinking about one instrument to help to support that mandate. And that instrument over the last 20 years or so has been the Fed moving around the interest rate. Now, they're doing that in a way to try to, first of all, maintain an inflation target, currently 2%, and secondly, to try to maintain maximum employment. Now, if you have two targets, you need two instruments. And whereas I'm happy to have the Fed continue to move around interest rates in an attempt to hit the inflation target, I'd also like to see them doing something that they've been learning about really in the last few years, which is intervening in financial markets. So what I see moving forward, instead of thinking about a mix of monetary and fiscal policy, which is very slow to implement, I'd see central banks doing what they've traditionally done, which is moving around interest rates and in a way in an attempt to meet the inflation target, and at the same time changing the composition of the assets they hold to minimize financial fluctuations and to try to maintain full employment.
Now, I have two questions to follow up there. One is, isn't the Federal Reserve stepping into a vacuum because there is no fiscal policy coming off of Capitol Hill and they were forced into this kind of action?
Yes and no. So fiscal policy is, in my view, a second-best alternative. If by fiscal policy you mean counter-cyclical programs to build roads and bridges. And
yes.
The problem with that is it's slow. And we need something that acts much more quickly. Now, we've known for a long time that monetary policy acts quickly, but we need another dimension of that policy. What the Fed has learned in the last few years is that it's not just the size of its balance sheet that matters, which is the thing they've moved around to try and control interest rates. It's also the composition of its balance sheet. So what we saw after the 2008 crisis was the Fed not just increasing the size of its balance sheet, which it did enormously. It went up from $800 billion to something like $3 trillion or more. It was the kind of things the Fed was buying. Instead of just buying 3-month Treasury bills, which is what it had been doing in the past, it began to buy things like mortgage-backed securities, longer-term debt, and it tried really to push down or influence the prices of other kinds of assets. And I think that's something that I'd like to see institutionalized and formalized moving forward.
I see. So the quantitative easing that we came out of with them buying that was, in your opinion, the right kind of assets to an extent, but they could have gone a little deeper into different asset purchases, maybe on the markets. I'm just trying to get a firmer grasp of where you'd like to see the Fed put its money.
Yeah, absolutely. So now that we have this massive balance sheet, which is about currently $2-3 trillion, there are a number of opinions about what might happen to that moving forward. One is that we should just keep it there and let it go down very slowly. Another is we can, you know, leave the balance sheet there and not do very much moving forward. What I'd like to see is maintain this balance sheet, but trade it actively in a way to minimize the volatility that we're seeing in asset markets. And that may sound to be a kind of strange proposal. It's backed up by research. So I'd say that a common opinion amongst economists is that fluctuations in the stock market don't matter very much. There's a saying that goes that something like the market's predicted, you know, 10 of the last 3 recessions or something like that. I don't remember the exact quote, comes from Samuelson.
Right.
But the truth is, although the day-to-day movements in the markets don't do very much, movements in the markets that persist are a very good predictor of how the real economy is going to move 3 months later. And in my work, I've looked at that connection very closely in the whole post-war period, and I find that persistent market movements are followed by persistent movements in unemployment rates.
Right.
So there are two ways of thinking about why that might be. One is, if you see that something precedes something else, doesn't necessarily mean that it causes it. So one way of thinking about that is you might imagine that you watch the weather forecast every night.
Mm-hmm.
And when the weather forecaster says it's going to rain tomorrow, you figure you should take your umbrella. Now, that's an instance of something preceding something else. You see the weather forecaster and you know it's probably going to rain. But if we tell the weather forecaster just to change his mind and say, no, it's going to be sunny tomorrow, that's probably not going to do very much to what actually happens to the weather.
I see.
Now, there's another example, which is what I think of the forest fire example. So if you imagine that you've had a long, dry, hot summer and somebody goes out and smokes a cigarette in the forest and drops a cigarette butt, that's going to be followed by a forest fire. And in that case, if you stop the guy from going out and smoking in the forest, you are going to prevent forest fires. So the fact that movements in the stock market precede movements in the real economy don't necessarily mean that one causes the other. And in order to infer that one causes the other, you really need to have an explanation about why that might be. So, you know, most of the work I've done in the last 20 years is about why that might be. And in my view is that movements in wealth, in stock market wealth, which are generated by purely optimism, what Keynes called animal spirits, actually lead to causal movements in the real economy.
Ah. Asset prices and valuations are tied to unemployment. They're correlative or causal.
They're not just correlated, they're causal. That's right.
I see. Okay. We're speaking with Professor Roger Farmer. He's the author of Prosperity for All, How to Prevent Financial Crises. Are stocks being tied to unemployment moving forward, is that anywhere squared with income inequality, or are those two completely separate things? And I might be reaching. It's something that occurred to me last night as I was going to bed.
I know. I wouldn't say you're reaching, because it's a concern. If you stand out and say, well, I think that the Fed or government should be propping up financial markets, there's an obvious question, which is, you know, are you simply propping up the wealth of the top 1%? Financial markets happen to be, you know, one kind of wealth that we can actually influence, but they're highly correlated with future value of labor income and other kinds of wealth. So inequality is certainly a concern. It's something that I think we need different kinds of policies to think about. I think the ones that I called the book Prosperity for All. And the reason for that is we all suffer from financial crises. How much we suffer is, I think, connected with other issues. So we can talk about inequality, but it's, I think, a separate issue.
Okay, that's fine. And so would it be fair to say that you would like the technicians to change their models to incorporate more of this causal relationship that you've noticed in your research?
By technicians, you mean policymakers at the Fed, yes.
Let's talk about coming out of the Great Recession, and maybe you can help me understand. And I do a couple of features within the show called Teachable Moments. If it's okay, can we start with the metaphor you used or borrowed for the rocking horse economy? Maybe make that a teachable moment and explain to me what that rocking horse economy metaphor means. And then I'd like to get into multipliers versus austerity.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
I don't know, a teachable moment.
It could be a teachable moment for them. This
ends up being what's called a teachable moment.
In the book, and in a previous book I wrote called How the Economy Works, I introduced what I think of two metaphors. So one is the way that most economists currently think about the way the economy works, and that's what I call the rocking horse analogy. So that analogy is, you know, think of the economy as a rocking horse, and there's a kid there with a club, and he's randomly hitting the rocking horse. Now, the dynamics of the rocker, the internal dynamics of the rocker, those are like the dynamics of the economy. So in other words, if you just hit the rocker once and watch and wait, the rocking horse will slowly end up, it will go back and forth, and eventually it will come to rest. If you now think about what happens if you hit it randomly and repeatedly, that rocking horse will fluctuate randomly and repeatedly, but the way it moves will depend not just on the physics of the rocking horse, it will also depend on the sequence of shocks, the blows that the kid gives it with the club. And that's how most economists think about the economy we're looking at now. It moves back and forwards, but it's always coming back to the same point. Now, there's another analogy that I call the windy boat analogy, which is what I think we should be thinking about. And that's that the economy is not like a rocking horse. It's like a sailboat on the ocean with a broken rudder. And instead of thinking about the shocks as a kid with a club, think about the wind that's blowing the boat. One way, it's blowing the boat the other way. Mm-hmm. And because the rudder's broken, the boat could end up anywhere. So there's no tendency there if you think of the economy analogy, there's no tendency for the economy to come back to full employment. And that was, for me, the big insight in Keynesian economics, and it's one that we've forgotten in the last 30 years or so, and it's one that we need to bring back. So the big insight, important book, Keynes's book called The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, that was written in the 30s, big insight of that book was that in the absence of a mechanism, a political mechanism, to try and stabilize the economy, we could end up with a depression forever. And, you know, I'm very concerned that without understanding the way the economy works, we could end up with another couple of decades of slow growth and underperforming economy.
We're speaking with Roger Farmer, Professor Roger Farmer, author of Prosperity for All. Professor Farmer, Keynes is a giant in the economics field, obviously, but you mentioned right there, the general theory came out in the 30s when we were a manufacturing society and our economy was completely different. Why are we still applying Keynesian methods and theories to the 21st century?
Oh, I think there are insights that we learn as a society as we move along, and some of them are right and some of them are wrong. And we're continually evolving institutions. I think many of the things we learned from the general theory and from Keynes have stood us in very good stead. So let me give you an example. You know, if you look at the history of fluctuations, business cycles in the economy back from the 19th century right through to the present day, you find that the economy was much more volatile in the period before Keynes wrote the general theory. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that we've successfully, I think, been intervening. So the notion that government or politics should somehow have some kind of role in influencing the real economy is very new. And it came in 1936 with Keynes's book. And before that, most people accepted that there might be a role potentially for governments trying to think about inflation. But the idea that the fiscal or the monetary authority should be maintaining full employment was very new. Mm. And I think it was a successful innovation.
All right, Professor Farmer, let's bring it to present day, because we are sitting on the precipice of what I think is going to be a rate hike this month in September. A lot of people are betting against me and saying in December. Can we apply your theory to what might happen in a couple of weeks with the Fed? What are the repercussions in your mind if there is a Fed rate hike right now? And how does that affect markets and other factors?
Okay, so I've gone on the record recently as saying I think there should be a rate hike, but a rate hike on its own with no other intervention, I think, would not be good for the real economy. This comes back to this idea that if there are two things that you want to try and target, the inflation rate and the unemployment rate, you need two instruments. So if there's a rate hike in the near future, and if the markets decide that that's not a good thing, and I think they're quite likely to, there's a real danger that the rate hike will trigger a recession, or at least a new slowdown, and potentially an increase in unemployment. And the reason for that is the rate hike will be associated with a drop in the financial markets. So this is where the second instrument comes in. If you're going to raise the interest rate, which is associated really with a reduction in the size of the Fed's balance sheet, typically, you want to do something else at the same time, which is prevent the crash in the markets. So absorb the risk that the financial markets are not willing to do by taking it on to the federal balance sheet, either in the Fed or the Treasury.
Okay. I was heartened at the beginning of your answer because you kind of agreed with my amateur opinion that we need those 25 basis points, but I can see the long tail that you're describing. One of the other arguments in here that really fascinated me in your book, Prosperity for All, was multipliers versus austerity. Now, the last time the word austerity was really in the business headline lexicon, if you will, was during the EU and the Grexit with Greece. Can you help explain to me the difference between multipliers and austerity when you're coming out of a financial crisis?
Yeah, so the idea behind multipliers, again, goes back to the general theory, and for me, it's the part of the general theory that I think was wrong. Keynes advocated, as a potential way of trying to get out of recessions, big fiscal expenditure programs, government should spend more. The austerity guys, so there's a whole group of people that were opposed to that idea, took the view that markets were pretty much self-stabilizing, and if governments were to spend more, the private sector would spend less. Now, Keynes thought that was wrong, and he thought it was wrong because he thought that spending, consumption spending, which is about two-thirds of the economy, depends on income. I think one of the things we learned in the coming out of World War II with a lot of research was that consumption spending depends on wealth, not on income.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of the multiplier was, you spend more, you generate, and government spends more, it borrows to do it, that generates jobs, people spend more, as they spend more, so more jobs are created. Problem with that is that when governments spend more, they influence interest rates, and if they influence interest rates, they can drive down private spending. Now, you might say, well, how can they drive down interest rates when they're essentially, or how can they drive, they're not going to drive up interest rates in a recession,
right?
When interest rates are kind of zero anyway. And the response I have to that is it really matters, how that spending's financed. So, interest rates at the short end of the yield curve, that is, if you borrow for 3 months, you can borrow for almost nothing. If you try to borrow for 20 years, you're still borrowing at a positive rate. And it's still possible, if you spend a lot of money and you borrow at the long end of the yield curve, to crowd out private people who are also borrowing at that level. So I think it matters. I'm not a huge – I wouldn't say I'm an opponent of spending. If you look at infrastructure in the U.S., our roads are crumbling, our bridges are crumbling. We certainly need to spend more on infrastructure,
right?
not least of which because – in order for the private economy to function, you need a road system to
right.
take things from one place to another. But I don't think we should be confusing that with, what you should be doing in recessions. And the other thing is, if there is an infrastructure spending program, I think it matters very much how it's financed. And we need to think a lot about not only the risk composition of assets that are held, but the long versus short borrowing.
Is a government-funded infrastructure spending program a jobs creator and bill?
I think it depends how it's financed.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I was just extrapolating on your previous answer.
For example, some people are advocating what they call helicopter money right now as a way out. So, again, depends how you think about that. One of the views of what that means is the Fed would simply create money and send a check to everybody in the economy. Would that create jobs? I think so, yes.
Okay.
On the other hand, if there was an expenditure program that was financed, as some people are advocating, by issuing 20, 30-year bonds because they're cheap right now, I think that that kind of spending has the potential still to prevent some of those private projects that people were going to go ahead with. I think the main takeaway from all of this, and one of the things that I stress in the book, is that confidence, you know, the way people think about the economy, actually influences what happens. So I have a way of saying that. I say when we feel rich, we are rich.
Yes. Professor Farmer, your book is Prosperity for All, How to Prevent Financial Crises. It's been a wonderful thing to talk with you. We could go deeper into a lot of different areas. I wish we had more time, so maybe we can have you back in a month or so.
Okay. Be very happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Again, Prosperity for All by Professor Roger Farmer, How to Prevent Financial Crises. I suggest if you give a crap about the economy, you need to read this book. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
That was Roger Farmer, a distinguished professor of economics at UCLA. He is also a fellow of the Economic Society, research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and co-editor of the International Journal of Economic Theory. For a full version of our discussion, please check out the segment links at facebook.com/techonomicsradio or check out kgoradio.com/techonomics. Coming up after this short break, we have a friend of the show and Silicon Valley stalwart, Sarah Lacey. Sarah has a new look at being a woman and mother in the Valley, as well as her take on the EU's saber-rattling over Apple's taxation strategies. Please, come on back.